The Guardian. Book of the Week with Claire Armistead on guardian.co.uk.
The drama of this year's London Book Fair was all about the people who didn't make it. I know, I was stranded in Beirut with several of them. So did anything actually come out of it? We'll find out later in the programme. We'll give you the lowdown on the Orange Prize shortlist, and we have a rare treat for you, a new short story from Helen Simpson, which you'll read herself. But first, Damon Galgut, one of the writers who did manage to beat the volcano cloud. He was at the book fair to help out with the South African focus. I managed to get back in time to grab him before he left to discuss his latest work, In a Strange Room. Appropriately enough, it's a triptych of traveller's tales. He began with reading from the first story in which two strangers meet up in Greece.
It happens like this. He sets out in the afternoon on the track that has been shown to him, and soon he leaves the little town behind. In an hour or so, he is among low hills covered by olive trees and grey stones, from which there is a view out over a plain that gradually descends to the sea. He is intensely happy, which is possible for him when he is walking and alone. As the road rises and falls, there are moments when he can see far ahead, and other moments when he can see nothing at all. He keeps looking out for other people, but the huge landscape seems to be completely deserted. The only sign of human beings is the occasional house, tiny and distant, and the fact of the road itself. Then, at some point, as he comes to the crest of a hill, he becomes aware of another figure far away. It could be male or female, it could be any age, it could be travelling in either direction, towards him or away. He watches until the road dips out of sight, and when he comes to the top of the next rise, the figure is clearer, coming towards him. Now they are watching each other, while pretending they are not. When they draw even, they stop. The figure is a man about his own age, dressed entirely in black. Black pants and shirt, black boots. Even his rucksack is black. What the first man is wearing, I don't know. I forget.
Damon Galgut, reading from In a Strange Room. Many readers will know him from his novel The Good Doctor, which was shortlisted for the Booker Prize back in 2003. I suggested to him that this book was rather different, not least because hardly any of it is actually set in South Africa.
It is. I mean, you know, for many reasons, I think I reached a point where I actually wanted to look at things that were not connected to South Africa. It's very easy to get South Africa fatigue when you're, you know, continually focused on and talking about politics, history, and, you know, the kind of set of questions that one usually gets into when you're dealing with that particular country.
And it's called In a Strange Room. It could actually be called Figures in a Landscape or something, couldn't it?
Yeah, it could. The title, in fact, comes from a William Faulkner quote from As I Lay Dying. But I chose it for a couple of reasons, but the main one being that it really conjures what's at the heart of the book, which is being away from home, somewhere strange. And the book's dealing with that experience, I mean, in one way or another.
And it consists of three, you could say, almost like novellas with a single central character. Although in a way he's not even a single central character, because there's the him who's living the experience and there's an I who is the person who recalls him living the experience. Tell us a little bit about this structure. He is called Damon. Is that you?
Yeah. Basically, the project that I set myself with this book was quite simple. It was to recall as honestly and truthfully as I could three journeys that I've taken at different points in my life. They've all been very important journeys for one reason or another. Each of these journeys was made with one other person, and I wanted to tell the story not only of the journey itself, the details of the travel, in other words, but to give an account of how my relationship with the other person changed through the arc of the journey. Now, very soon after I sat down to write, it became clear to me that these stories had a deeper subject, and that was memory. In other words, it wasn't only the journey or the relationship that I was recounting, but it was the way I remembered it. And I wanted to convey something of the quality of how memory works in the way I wrote it. Now, I've done that in a number of ways, but the most obvious one, noticeable one, is the one you've picked up on, which is the shift in the point of view.
So, for example, you have a sentence which goes, happy and unhappy, he falls asleep in the end and dreams about, no, I don't remember his dreams.
Yes, quite. At places where memory fails me, I've tried to set that down too. At the points where, you know, there's a hole in memory, I've conveyed that.
So is this a novel?
Well, that's a good question. It's been published as a novel. It's been published as fiction. These pieces appeared first in the Paris Review, and they, at the time they were going to run them, said to me, well, what should we call them? I mean, is this a memoir? Is this a travelogue? Anyway, they took the decision to publish it as fiction, and I became very happy with that decision for the reason that memory is fiction. I came to this conclusion in the writing of the book. All memory is a way of reconstructing the past. If you actually consider it, the memory of any particular moment or set of moments consists of a whole lot of really disparate impressions and perceptions. There isn't really a narrative thread to memory. In other words, the color of the wall of this room, the temperature of the air, you know, the headache that I might be feeling at the moment are all part of the memory too. But when you actually sit down to reconstruct those impressions and perceptions into a coherent narrative, you have to pick out particular things and raise them to significance at the expense of other things which will fall by the wayside. Mm-hmm. So the act of narrating a memory is an act of creating a fiction, mm-hmm. and I wanted to convey that fact.
Let's go to the first of the stories, The Follower, which you actually just did a reading from. In this case, you meet up with a rather sinister German character.
Yeah.
And there's a sense of menace all the time, but the sense of menace doesn't actually come to anything that's very dangerous. And I thought that was very interesting because it's as if the sense of menace, who has the sense of menace? Is the menace in the mind of the character who's living with this person, or is the menace in the mind of the narrator who's looking back on it many years later?
Whether the sense of menace is created in the remembering or whether I felt that all the time is sometimes hard to say. I mean, that's part of the reason I look on it as a fiction. It was my sense that the entire journey, because it took place in a remote landscape. We went hiking in the mountains of Lesotho, where if anything happened to you, you would not be found for days, if at all. Also, the nature of my connection with this particular man sat on the edge of, you know, potential danger all the time.
He's like almost a psychopath in some of his minor relationships with what he does.
Well, yeah, I guess you could see him that way. I mean, he may not be happy to be described in those terms, but he certainly was on his own path very much and wasn't very interested in accommodating other people's visions or views. He was a very difficult traveling companion to have. But the nature of that whole journey was defined by power. That's why it's called The Follower. You know, it's a relationship of power in which I think I was very much at the receiving end until I finally found a way to break out.
Now, the second story, The Lover, deals with desire in a very shifting landscape. Tell us a little bit about that.
Well, it's an account of a journey I made. I even forget the year at this point. It's all a little blurry, but somewhere in the 90s, I think 95 or so, I went up to Zimbabwe to wander around for a bit, and I got in with a group of travelers that took me on to Malawi. And on the way, I fell in with another group of travelers. And our lives became very closely connected through a series of coincidences. We kept sort of parting and then meeting again in ways we hadn't planned to. Yeah, and it led to a prolonged moment of love in my life, which I think had, hadn't been the case for quite a long time.
And then the third big theme is, it seemed to me, is responsibility. And indeed, the third story is called The Guardian.
Well, it tells the story of Damon accompanying his friend Anna to India. Anna's in a very bad way and actually in a far worse state than I could ever have realized at the time. And things went disastrously wrong in India. You know, the three stories are called The Follower, The Lover and The Guardian. And guardianship is the theme of the third story. But in fact, I think these three relationships, power, love, and guardianship, are the three primary human relationships, the ones that any significant emotional connection you have with another human being is going to fall into one of these categories, or more than one.
Mm. And the theme of The Guardian actually seemed particularly pointed to me. I've just got back from Beirut across land through Europe. And it seemed to me that Europe is full of people taking care of each other who don't know each other.
Right.
And once you've made that responsibility, you're sort of stuck with them.
Yeah, I guess it's a door that when you've opened, it's very hard to close it again. I mean, maybe easier to do with strangers who, you know, you don't know in any context. But if you're taking care of a friend or somebody you love, how do you ever give up that responsibility? I mean, some people find a way to do it, but I would find it impossible, I think. And I certainly was the only person in India there to look after Anna under the circumstances described and couldn't walk away from that situation at all.
Mm. Now, the styles of these three are quite different in a way, aren't they? I mean, it struck me that the most horrible, in a way, story, the final story about this very sick friend of yours, is almost like a black comedy.
Well, again, you know, there's no creative invention at work. I was simply recounting the events that took place. So, yeah, I guess if you're looking at it from the outside, a lot of it is darkly comic, but, you know, in a fateful sort of way.
Having to get clothes in order for her to be decent to go in an ambulance to an intensive care unit, for example, because they won't carry her without decent clothes. Did that all happen?
Yes. Yeah, it did.
Is this a path that you're going to pursue in future, or will you go back to more conventional fiction?
You know, I feel this is territory I've covered, and I will probably go back to a more conventional form of fiction after this, but I might surprise myself. I have in the past.
Damon Galgut. In a Strange Room is published by Atlantic. As I mentioned earlier, Galgut was in London to appear at the London Book Fair as part of the South African market focus. Also there was Benedicta Page of the publisher's Bible, The Bookseller. She joins me now in the studio along with the critic and broadcaster Alex Clark. Welcome, both of you. Let's start with South Africa. Ben, was this a complete washout, or did people manage to attend?
Well, it was very disappointing. Obviously, so much preparation goes into this, and to be hit by the volcanic ash cloud disaster was unbelievably disappointing. The London Book Fair and the British Council had put together a big seminar of events, author readings. I think they had 47 authors and publishers coming over from South Africa for this market focus. And of that, I think about 12 managed to get there. So, of course, that was a massive blow. There were some authors who had managed to get here early. I think Andre Brink was at the fair and he stepped in, and, you know, authors stepped in and took over parts in seminars for people who hadn't managed to make it. And so everyone tried to carry on. And rather amusingly, there was an event in a bookshop in Cape Town called Not the London Book Fair, when all the authors who couldn't make it got together and had readings and talks. And that was a sort of virtual link up with that. Uh-huh. So everybody did their best, but it was not what it had been hoped to be, obviously.
Now, we've had focuses on the Arab world and India before. Is this a successful formula? Does it actually mean anything? Does it mean that in 2 years' time we will be getting more novels from South Africa?
I think it does definitely have a strong effect. I mean, it's not sort of the meat and drink of the fair. You don't do lots of deals, you know, there and then when this happens. But, you know, the book trade, it's a relationships business. It's about getting to know each other, knowing what each other's tastes are, what works in someone's market, what they're fascinated by that could work in your market. And you definitely do see a building of contacts, trade and author contacts, that results in concrete changes. For example, a couple of years ago, it was the Arab world focus. And there have definitely been a lot of initiatives that have come up since then, whether as a direct result of the fair or by a sort of seeping effect. For example, Bloomsbury's got a new publishing venture with State of Qatar, where they jointly publish in Arabic and English, and they've got all sorts of literacy initiatives. That's come up since the fair focus. And also, you know, Beirut 39, this joint venture between the Hay Festival and Beirut. So you can definitely see that there's an impact, yes.
Alex, is this something we need? I mean, we don't see that much from South Africa, really, at the moment, do we?
Not really. I mean, I have to say, my knowledge of South African literature as it's coming through now is pretty woeful. I mean, beyond Andre Brink and J.M. Coetzee, I'm pretty pretty much an ignoramus. So it's kind of interesting to think that if this works in sort of 2 or 3 years' time, we'll see more published here. I don't know. The London Book Fair is one of those things. It's very limited how much it gets out into the public consciousness, isn't it? It's not for the general reader. Mm. And I think probably even less than, say, something like Frankfurt. It's not something that's particularly on anybody's radar outside the immediate trade. So I don't know.
Mm. Now, Ben, tell me about some of the other issues that came up at the fair.
Well, we're all very obsessed by digital publishing at the moment. You know, that's a big issue for us. We're all very fascinated by the degree to which the book industry is going to be transformed by technological developments. So that was a big theme in terms of the seminars and the conference discussion at the fair. Obviously, particularly the iPad is coming this summer, which opens up different kinds of publishing because it's got big screen, it's colour. That means that things like children's illustrated books and graphic novels, there are new opportunities there. And there are an enormous number of new projects announced, you know, small and large, announced by people at the fair, you know, new apps for cookery apps for Nigella and a new app for Nicola Barker's new novel.
Does this make you feel a bit queasy, Alex? Somebody who actually I imagine is quite wedded to the old technology of the book.
And of course you'll strut out the same thing, don't you? You always say, but the book is the perfect technology, it's portable and it doesn't need recharging. I can't bear the thought of getting to the final page and the whole thing suddenly dying. However, I do see myself in kind of 3 or 4 years' time saying I don't know how I lived without this, because that's how it works, isn't it? And the thought of being able to go on holiday, not weighed down and getting terrible shoulder injury by the 25 books you can't live without, and having them all on a handy device is quite attractive.
Have you iBooked up yet?
No.
No, I have not. I've barely got a mobile phone.
Sort of occasionally, I borrow one from time to time. But you're right, I should have one as part of my daily life, and I'm sure I will have very soon.
But one of the interesting ones that I noticed was this Naomi Alderman collaboration with a games developer. Now, Naomi Alderman,
yes.
It came to light with her first novel, which is about the Orthodox Jewish community, wasn't it? Mm. She's just got her second novel out. What is this? Is this something completely separate?
Yes, it's something completely separate. And I think that was one of the very interesting developments of this fair, which was, it's not just looking at how publishers are thinking differently about what they can do with their role, but also an author getting very excited about the different creative possibilities that new technologies offer. This is a kind of collaboration that Naomi has done. I think he's a games developer, someone called Jay Bidulf. And they've done it as a project. I think it's sponsored by BookTrust, and it's simply online. It's called The Winter House. I think you can look at it online at thewinterhouse.co.uk. And it's just an example where Naomi has written a narrative and got together with this developer to create something that's really very beautiful. It's not a game. It is a narrative. You go through it at your own pace. But it's got the most beautiful kind of visual accessories, if you like, and sound as well. And it's a really, you know, very creative experience. And Naomi was speaking really very eloquently about how excited she felt about the new creative possibilities that were going to be opening up over the next years as people explored new technologies.
And now to the Orange Shortlist, which was announced during the book fair. Alex, can you just run us through the titles?
I will. We start off with The Very Thought of You by Rosie Allison. That's a debut novel. The Lacuna by Barbara Kingsolver, which I think is her first novel for quite some time, quite a few years. Blackwater Rising by Attica Locke, which is another debut novel. It's a thriller. Wolf Hall probably needs no introduction by Hilary Mantel. Laurie Moore's A Gate at the Stairs. And The White Woman on the Green Bicycle by Monique Roffey.
Is this a good shortlist? I mean, there are a couple of people I haven't heard of.
You probably wouldn't have heard of Rosie Allison or Attica Locke, would you? Because those are the two debut novels. And, you know, they're interesting. I was a bit surprised to see something that is so clearly a very, very accomplished thriller, but a thriller nonetheless. And it's not that I'm sort of anti-genre novels making it onto prize shortlists, but it didn't seem to me terribly different from a lot of other accomplished crime novels. And also that The Very Thought of You, the other debut novel, I was also slightly bemused to see there in the company of Hilary Mantel and Laurie Moore. But I think it's an interesting list. I mean, you can't say it's not varied. and I found quite a lot that was interesting to read. I was particularly pleased to have read Monique Roffey's book.
Ben, there seems to have been a bit of pressure for genre to get onto these prize lists. I've been observing this over the last couple of years. Is this something that you think is a general thing?
Gosh, I don't know that that's the case, you know, Claire. I mean, I think it would be very hard for anyone to pressurise any of these notoriously independent juries, and I'm sure the Orange Board wouldn't have had a go. What I do think is, I think prize juries always want to spot new talent as well as to go for some of the more established writers. So there is a tendency certainly for new writers to appear on the list, and that may have been the case, for example, that may have been a factor perhaps in the choice of Blackwater Rising, I don't know.
So what about Laurie Moore? Is she at her best in novels, or do you think she's really a short story?
I was struck by how different it was from her short fiction, which I love, and I love this novel. So it seems to me you're sort of getting two writers for the price of one. Not that there's, you know, complete disjunction, but she really does something different. It's a really strangely kind of ambitious novel. I mean, it's quite odd, and also sort of thrillerish too, and I really loved it.
And she's really got to win it now, if she's going to win it, hasn't she? Because it might be another 14 years till she produces another novel.
You never know. She may have got into a stride now. We may get one a year.
Ben, just moving on to Wolf Hall, that couldn't possibly win the Orange, could it? I mean, we can't win the Booker and then the Orange.
Well, it is a strong possibility. I mean, I think looking at it purely from a book trade perspective, I guess booksellers would say perhaps one of the other novels would benefit more from the win. So I suppose there's, you know, there's that sense a little bit. But who knows? Who knows what the jury will decide?
Are there any novels, Alex, that you were sorry to see left off the shortlist?
Well, from the long list, I was surprised, we've been talking about debut novels, not to see Eleanor Catton's The Rehearsal there, because that struck me as a really distinctive debut. I mean, just a very kind of different take on writing, a very you know, it was a really original voice that you felt was coming through. And I was also a bit sorry not to see MJ Hyland go any further.
I was really disappointed that Sarah Waters didn't get further. I love The Little Stranger. I know it's quite controversial in some circles, but it's just such a good read.
I kind of enjoyed it. I saw it had certain limitations, and I think maybe it does suffer by comparison with her previous novels. Mm. And there's something, did you not find slightly sort of unsatisfactory about it? Well, you didn't, I guess.
No! I did not.
It was terribly frightening.
I gave it to all my family for Christmas, and they all loved it as well. Anyway, move on. Ben, there are a lot of independent publishers on this list, and particularly I notice Faber, who actually, I've just did a quick scroll down the past winners, and they've never actually won it, and they've got two contenders here.
Yes, that's interesting. There are a lot of independents on it, which is great to see. And actually, I was at a seminar at the London Book Fair, where obviously this shortlist was announced, at which Kate Moss, who's one of the, she's the Orange co-founder, was speaking, and she was, you know, pointing very much to this, to the fact that there were all these independent publishers on the shortlist, and saying, you know, really that there's such exciting stuff going on among the independents at the moment. It was a seminar about, you know, risk-averse publishing, basically, about, you know, whether British literature is becoming risk-averse. I must say there was a very robust response from Alison Samuel, who's the former publisher at Chatter, which, of course, is part of Random House, one of the four big publishers. So I think the argument can be made in several different directions, but it's particularly nice to see Alma Books on the shortlist. They're a new, very new publisher by comparison with Faber and Serpent's Tale. So, you know, it's nice to see them get that kind of boost.
Mm. And Serpent's Tale, of course, won before with the Lionel Shriver.
Yes, of course. Yes.
So now the moment. What are you going to be rooting for, girls? Come on, fess up.
Well, I would like Wolf Hall to win, because I think it is the best novel that I've read for many, many years. And I think that prizes should do nothing else than try to make the best book win and not look to other prizes and not look to the book trade and not look to pleasing constituencies. That having been said, I would be really happy if Laurie Moore won too, because I think that's an excellent book.
Well, I completely see your point, Alex. I suppose, you know, from the book trade point of view, one of the others, not Wolf Hall, I would have to back. The Laurie Moore, I think, would be a very interesting win.
Yeah, I think I'll back both of you. Thank you very much for coming in. One writer who would certainly be in the running for the Orange were it to loosen up a bit and admit short stories is Helen Simpson, who joined us to read from her new collection. It's called In-Flight Entertainment and its overarching theme is climate change. Guardian Booksite editor Sarah Crown met Helen when she came in and began by asking her why she had settled on this particular theme.
It was because it's such a difficult subject to deal with in fiction. I mean, it's absolutely intractable. You've got either science or you've got hectoring and moralising, and neither of those are good bases for writing stories. And I wasn't doing it for any polemical reason. I just think, you know, I don't write like that. The only duty a writer's got is to write about what stimulates their imagination, however embarrassing that might be. But this is a challenge for a story writer. I wanted to find different shapes, different ways in. So I did a dystopian one and a love story, which was about, you know, on the theme. I tried to find different ways in, and this one's a sales pitch, a sort of monologue.
And you're going to read for us now from the collection, this story?
Yes,
Ahead
this particular
of the Pack,
one.
It's called. OK, brilliant.
Ahead of the Pack. Thank you for making the time to see me. I do appreciate how busy you are, so I'll talk fast. I'd like you to think of this presentation as a 100-metre dash. Yes, you're right, it can be difficult to find finance for a new idea, but not in this case. I'm far more concerned about someone stealing this idea than turning it down, to be honest, which is why I want to tie up a joint venture agreement as soon as possible, by the end of the week, preferably. So, a little bit about where I'm coming from first. My original background was in TEFL, then in PR for various NGOs. I've had something of a portfolio career. But in the last decade, I've concentrated on developing my motivational skills in the areas of personal training and weight loss. I'm a zeitgeisty sort of person, and I've found I have this unerring instinct for homing in on what the next big thing will be. You could say I was like a canary in a mineshaft, but more positive, I hope. The next big thing? Well, carbon dioxide's the next big thing. Yes, I am talking global warming, but please don't glaze over quite yet. Yes, I do know how boring it is, how much of a downer it can be, but bear with me for the next 7 minutes, and I promise you'll be glad you did so. I know, there are still some people who say it isn't really happening, but they're like my weight loss clients who say it's glandular or I've got big bones. What they're really saying is they're not ready to change. Whereas the client who is ready to change is very often the one who's had a nasty scare. My prize slimmer is a man who'd been living high for years and then a routine scan revealed completely furred up carotid arteries. He had a great sense of humour. He used to wear a T-shirt with "I ate all the pies" on it. But underneath, his heart was breaking. Literally. At 20 stone, he was threatened with the very real prospect of a triple bypass, not to mention a double knee replacement, early onset diabetes and gout. Now, another client in a similar situation might have chosen to ignore the warning, opted to dig his grave with his own teeth, basically. I've seen that happen. I've been to the funeral. Fair enough, their choice. This man, though, a well-known local entrepreneur as it happens. No, I'm sorry, client confidentiality, I'm sure you'll understand. This man directed his considerable drive towards losing 7 stone over 10 months. And as a matter of fact, he finished in the first 35,000 in this year's London Marathon. And my point is? My point is, either we can carry on stuffing our faces and piling it on, or we can decide to lose weight. We've suddenly acquired this huge communal spare tyre of greenhouse gases. Our binging has made the planet morbidly obese and breathless. Food, fuel, same difference. See where I'm coming from? And that was my eureka moment when I realised that what's needed is a global slimming club. I thought of calling it Team 100 because we in the motivational world have a belief that it takes 100 days to change a habit. Plus, there are only 100 months left in which to save the world, apparently. Then I tried Enough's Enough. But that was too strict and possibly a teensy bit judgmental. Finally, I came up with Ahead of the Pack, which I think you'll agree sounds both positive and urgent. Plus, it has the necessary lean competitive edge. Perfect. It's simply a matter of time before it's compulsory for everyone. But those who've managed to adapt by choice in advance will be at a huge advantage, ahead of the pack. I mean, think of the difference between someone who's achieved gradual weight loss by adjusting their portion size and refusing second helpings, and someone else who's wolfed down everything but the kitchen sink for years and years and then wonders why he needs gastric banding. I know which one I'd rather be. Yes, you're right, that is exactly what I'm proposing, to set up as a personal carbon coach. In fact, I think you'll find that very soon it'll be mandatory for every company to employ an in-house emissions expert, so you might well find me useful here too in the not-too-distant future, if we're counting our chickens. The thing is, I have this programme tailor-made and ready to rock. I've already test-driven it for free on several of my clients and it's been fantastic. First off, I take their measurements, calculate the size of their carbon footprint, very like the BMI test, obviously, as carbon dioxide's measured in kilos too, and work out how far outside the healthy range they've strayed. We talk about why shortcuts don't work. Carbon capture and control pants, for example, squash the bad stuff out of sight rather than make it disappear. And somehow, magic solutions like fat-busting drugs and air scrubbers always seem to bring a nasty rash of side effects with them. Anyway, we visit the fridge next, discuss the long-distance Braeburn apples and the Antipodean leg of lamb, calculate their atmospheric calorie content. My clients generally pride themselves on their healthy eating habits, and they're amazed when I tell them that a flight from New Zealand is the equivalent of scoffing down two whole chocolate fudge cakes and an entire wheel of brie. We move on, room by room, talking weight loss as we go, how to organise loft insulation, where to find a local organic box scheme. I give advice on fitting a hippo in the loo and practical help with editing photo albums. Photo albums? Oh yes, very important. In 10 years' time, we'll be casting round for scapegoats. Children will be accusing parents, and wise parents will have disappeared all visual evidence of Dad's gap year in South America and Mum on Ayers Rock and the whole gang over in Florida waiting in line to shake Mickey's hand. Junk your fatso habits now, I advise them. Get ahead of the pack or you'll find yourself exposed. As hypocritical as a Victorian adjusting his antimacassars while the sweeps boy chokes to death up the chimney. Nobody will be able to plead ignorance either. We can all see what's happening on a daily basis on television. And if they have a second home, I advise them to sell it immediately. Sooner, if the second home is abroad. Of course, instant coronary time. Talk about a hot potato. Really? Oh. I hear what you're saying. You think I'm going directly against my target client base with that advice? Yes, well, maybe I do need to do some tweaking, some fine-tuning. Basically, though, and I'm aware that I've had my 10 minutes and I'd like to take this opportunity to thank you for your time. Basically, is it your feeling that you're prepared to invest in ahead of the pack? You'll get back to me on that one. I see. So, you happen to have a house near Perpignan, do you? Yes, it certainly is your hard-earned money. A bit of a wreck, but if you can get there for £29, why shouldn't you? No reason. Oh, reason, not the need, as Shakespeare says. As long as you know, of course, it means that, globally speaking, in terms of your planetary profile, you've got an absolutely vast arse.
Helen Simpson, reading Ahead of the Pack. It's just one of the delights in in-flight entertainment, which is just out from Jonathan Cape. And that's it for this week's podcast. Thanks to Damon Galgut, Helen Simpson, Benedicta Page and Alex Clark. There's more information on the Orange Prize at guardian.co.uk/books. Meanwhile, in the Guardian's Saturday Review, Chris Taylor gives his verdict on Helen Simpson, while Andy O'Hagan looks at talking animals in literature. On Sunday, in the Observer's new review, Kenan Malik reviews Eric Kaufman's provocative new book, Shall the Religious Inherit the Earth? And at guardian.co.uk/books, Sam Jordison continues his trawl through the Lost Booker shortlist with a review of Mary Renault's Fire from Heaven. Voting is now closed, but the result isn't announced till May the 19th, so do keep reading and letting us know what you think. We'll feed your comments back into the podcast when we discuss the winner. I'm off now to finish J.G. Farrell's Troubles. Thanks for listening. I'm Claire Armistead, and the podcast was produced by Scott Corley.
For more great downloads, go to guardian.co.uk/audio.